from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you were born in 1960 or after, you have lived in a great age of American unwinding, writes my guest today, George Packer. An age of once-honored institutions and assumptions coming apart. It can be bewildering, give you vertigo. It can feel like the end of America, the beginning of something new and unsettling. Packer's gone deep on it, on us. This hour, On Point, George Packer on the unwinding of America. Later in this hour, comedian Stephen Colbert tells the graduating class at the University of Virginia, you owe the previous generation nothing. We'll listen in. But first, joining me now from New York is George Packer, staff writer at The New Yorker. Packer takes on big issues. He's author of The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq, and Interesting Times, Writings from a Turbulent Decade. His new book is The Unwinding, an inner history of the new America, he calls it. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. George Packer's been called our modern-day George Orwell. Kirkus Reviews calls The Unwinding a foundational document in the literature of the end of America. You don't read that every day. George Packer, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you here.
And it's great to be back with you, Tom.
This is quite a book. People are comparing it to John Dos Passos, USA, a big trilogy, kind of in some ways a pastiche of, many lives here, some ordinary in the great and small sense of the word, some celebrity. But begin to introduce us, George. What is The Unwinding?
You described it well, Tom, at the beginning. I wanted to create a portrait of the country as it has changed in my adult lifetime, rather arbitrarily taking 1978 as a point of departure. I think what's happened over the last generation is certain institutions that used to support the aspirations of ordinary people didn't guarantee that everyone was going to make it or be the same, but supported the dreams of ordinary people and gave them the sense of having a place in the larger society, have begun to corrode and even to collapse. We could go through them one after another, but they're not a secret. Government, business, banking, the media, schools, all the key institutions that supported middle-class life in the period from, say, the 30s to the 70s, which you could call the Roosevelt Republic, mm-hmm. about a half a century in which America was truly a middle-class democracy, obviously excluding some groups, many groups. Women were second-class citizens during that time. Blacks were third-class citizens. Yep. But the country had the institutions that could correct themselves. It had the ability to widen the circle of opportunity, and it did. And it began to do that in the 60s and 70s. But simultaneously with that widening of opportunity has come this contraction where the middle class has been hollowed out. And many of the people who might have benefited from the inclusiveness of our generation, the greater inclusiveness, mm-hmm. have actually seen their fortunes diminish and even drop down to the bottom. So this strange parallel phenomenon of greater tolerance, greater openness, greater freedom. I mean, freedom is the bottom line for the era we live in. It
so
underlines
far.
Everything. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's always threats to it, and they come from both the government and from the Facebooks of our world to our privacy. But
and from ennui and disillusionment and maybe disarray sometimes. But anyway, yeah.
that can undermine it too. I'd say what we've traded is we've gotten more freedom. We've given up more security. And all you have to do is travel to any small town or old industrial city or rural area around the country and find the cost of that trade and how it's hurt ordinary people and how they feel they're alone, that those structures that used to support their dreams are no longer there and they have to make their own way. And that's the story I wanted to tell through the characters who are at the heart of The Unwinding.
You've gone so deep in these lives, some, again, ordinary, others, big celebs are sort of modern-day Gatsbys as you present them, Oprah and Jay-Z and Newt Gingrich and Peter Thiel, the PayPal co-founder, Silicon Valley guy. I mean, we're thinking about ordinary people, all kinds of people in Oklahoma today with this big tornado coming down on them. I was thinking as
Absolutely.
I watched the coverage of that, how and this related tied into your book somehow. We tend to see things as end times signals these days. I quoted Kirkus. You know, they read your book, and you talk about, George, the hollowing out of the middle class. We've been talking about that for decades now. But they read The Unwinding, and they talk about a foundational document in the literature of the end of America. Why do you think people are feeling that way about this?
I don't know that it's the end of America. It may be the end of America as we've known it. You know, one way to see this is there are these periodic periods of upheaval and of radical change and transformation. The period right after the founding of the country was one such. The Civil War was another. The crash of 29 and the Great Depression was a third. And in each case, the country found a way to create new structures that continue to make it a democracy that included larger and larger numbers of people in opportunity. Mm-hmm. We haven't figured out how to do that. Some people think the internet is the answer, that, you know, social networking is a new form of value, and that if you don't have a job or you don't make a lot of money, you still have, you know, your friends on Facebook or on Twitter. And I'm very skeptical. I don't think the internet has replaced the industries that supported middle-class life. It's made a few people very rich. You can read about it on the front page of the New York Times today. Two very interesting headlines. Billions in taxes avoided by Apple, yep, which reminds us that Silicon Valley, after all, is just another industry with self-interested corporations. And then the story of Tumblr being sold to Yahoo, which is, again, a kind of winner-take-all jackpot in which a young man with a brilliant idea becomes a multi-millionaire in his 20s. Has it created real value for the majority of people across the country? Not yet. Will it? I don't know. But that's the darkness that's at the, you know, sort of on the margins of my book. I don't think my story is an entirely dark story, and I hope we'll talk about the characters at the heart of it because they are the things that give me some hope.
Well, I want to give us a quick intro of each of them and the celebs. You've got Oprah in here and Jay-Z and Bob Rubin, who was Treasury Secretary and so high in Citigroup, so much to do with the deregulation era, and Newt Gingrich. How did you decide, how did you pick your everyman characters? How did you pick your celebs and why, George?
Well, let's start with the celebs. You mentioned those pastas, and he was kind of a model for me. I love the USA trilogy. It's not much read anymore, but it's a fantastically inventive way in fictional form to tell the history of the early 20th century in America. I picked celebrities from different institutions and walks of life. Newt Gingrich, to me, represents everything that's gone wrong with politics in the last generation. He will be remembered as maybe even more important than Bill Clinton.
You write of his colleagues, he gave them mustard gas, the sort of deadly politics, and they used it on every conceivable enemy, including him.
Including him. He in the end, was cannibalized by the revolutionaries he brought into Congress. Yeah, he created the politics of absolute bitter polarization, of using language to demonize the opponent into an enemy. Even the politics of big money, he profited from that greatly. So Newt Gingrich is a seminal figure in our politics. Robert Rubin, you know, decent man, brilliant
policy guy. You take him down a notch and a half.
But he represented Wall Street and Washington in a period of ever-widening inequality, and his policies really in the end didn't do anything to mitigate that. And at the end of his career on Wall Street, he was making millions and millions of dollars while Citigroup was about to nearly take the banking system down with it, yeah, and turn to the public for essentially, you know, a bailout. So there's a quality, and Jay-Z is this fascinating figure. He comes from a housing project. He's a drug dealer, and then he just by sheer force of will and talent and the will to win rises up to the very top of music and clothing and sports. He's friends with presidents, and he's a great example of how without the normal structures, there's this sense among young people that you have to cut in line. You have to say, I'm not going to do the normal thing of holding down a steady job and slowly rising because that doesn't work anymore. I am going to force my way to the top by breaking the rules and maybe breaking the law. Mm-hmm. So all of these characters to me, these celebrity characters, different walks of life. Alice Waters in the area of food, Oprah Winfrey in television, Sam Walton in business, the founder of Walmart. They all in some ways represent institutions no longer working for ordinary people, and these people building their own empires, essentially from scratch in many cases. They're all coming out of very hard or obscure backgrounds and in the classic American way, reinventing themselves up to the top.
Kind of the Gatsbys of our time. And in this case,
exactly.
Stepping up on the rubble of institutions falling apart. If you feel vertigo, there's a reason for that in our country in recent decades, George Packer writes in his new book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. George, stand by in New York. Julia Klein in the Chicago Tribune says the whole book reminds her of a Springsteen song. Maybe the Wrecking Ball album. He's behind us right here. Listeners, you can join us. Have you seen the America you know, we knew, drift away, become less equal, less hopeful, less knit together? What's going on? 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook with George Packer. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New Yorker writer George Packer about the end of America as we've known it and maybe what comes next. His big new book is The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And we are thinking throughout as we talk today about everybody who's been hit so hard by that monster tornado in Oklahoma. We will look tomorrow at possibility of re-engineering Tornado Alley, or maybe impossibility, to deal with that kind of superstorm. A foundational document of the literature of the end of America is how Kirkus Reviews sees this new book, and it goes deep on lives that are coming undone. George, introduce us just a little to the ordinary folks who are at the heart of this book. You've got three of them up against three different maybe kinds of tides. Take us in.
Yeah, I wanted to find people whose lives sort of coincided with the period of the book, the past generation. So let's talk first about Dean Price, who's a guy about 50 years old in rural North Carolina, grew up in the Bible Belt tobacco country. His father was a preacher. His family had been tobacco farmers forever. Dean had the dream of being an entrepreneur. One of his heroes was Steve Jobs, and he started a chain of truck stops in his part of North Carolina and gradually found that he was just getting squeezed out by Sheetz and other national chains, by Walmart, by all the big box stores and the big oil companies. And he sort of had an epiphany. He would spend evenings sitting out on his front porch, which faced a highway, and he up the hill was the Bojangles that he owned. A fast food place. And he would hear the trucks rushing by in the dark. And he knew that some of them were carrying loads of chickens that were hormone fed, so overweight they couldn't walk, to the slaughterhouses. And those chickens would then come back up to his store, his Bojangles, where very disgruntled workers not getting paid very much would cook them into the food that was being sold. And he imagined their hatred of the work sort of seeping into the food. And they would sell it to local people who would eat this food and get very, very overweight because of the terrible diet that fast food becomes. And in the end would, have to be hospitalized, or would get diabetes, and would be forced to drive an electric wheelchair around the Walmart supercenter that was forcing him out of business.
We've all seen
like those hormone-fed chickens. Mm-hmm. And this sort of nightmare vision of his own region, which he loves and which is he's completely connected to, inspired him to try something new. And what he got into was biofuels and the idea of using canola seeds and even the waste oil from the very Bojangles and other restaurants that are scattered across the landscape.
Sure.
to make diesel fuel for school buses so that the schools could save money because the schools are strapped for cash. And, you know, he hasn't made a killing off this. He still has the aspiration to be a great entrepreneur. This is his idea for how to resurrect this sort of fallen landscape of the Carolina Piedmont. And it's, to me, one of the sort of inspiring and just utterly American stories that you find as soon as you start traveling around outside the big cities and the coastal areas.
And yet it makes your heart ache. I mean, that, as you so beautifully put it, the hatred seeping into the food in that fast food restaurant and that fallen landscape that, you know, maybe he'll do something for it and maybe he won't. He's off on his own. It can sound quite quixotic.
It is quixotic, and he's totally on his own. He's figuring this thing out by, you know, talking to his neighbors, by seeing what happened to his own business because of Walmart and other, you know, big chains, and by looking at the internet and picking up little bits of information from this blog or that website. And there are no this is what we were talking about earlier. There are no structures that are supporting him. And he took me through the main street of the town he grew up in called Madison, North Carolina. And all we passed was one shuttered up pharmacy, restaurant, shoe store after another, just a couple of pedestrians on the sidewalks. And he told me the people who ran those stores were the pillars of this community. They were the Little League coaches. They were the town councilmen. They headed up the local civic groups. And once they lost their livelihood, the town lost its, you know, sort of the mainstays of life.
Yeah.
And imagine that happening in small towns across the country. It's not hard to find stories like this. And the Dean Prices, who are these essentially startup entrepreneurs inventing things kind of out of scratch and out of what's right around them, are, to me, the hopeful sign in this pretty bleak landscape.
Not hard to find. I mean, it's hard not to find. It's so omnipresent. You write about it here in Dean Price's story. Different faces of this. Tammy Thomas out of Youngstown, Ohio. Young black woman goes to work in the factory there and ends up a community organizer. Jeff Connaughton, a Washington political player who ends up with great disillusionment after his time as a Joe Biden guy.
And a lobbyist, yeah.
And a lobbyist. People are just responding to this like crazy as we speak, George. And I want to begin to bring their comments into the conversation because they everybody wants to hear the stories, and you tell them wonderfully both the sort of celebrity stories here. You've got some real takedowns in here, and also the ordinary stories. But people are really worried about this. I mean, here's a listener who says, an unsustainable standard of living was created for us at the conclusion of the Second World War. The good times rolled for almost half a century. It is coming to an end. No more promises about education, healthcare, retirement. Welcome back to the brave old world, which describes it almost inevitable in a way. I don't know. And here's another listener. Brett says, there are some who say the good times rolled only for a few years out of World War II. Then the Cold War, JFK's assassination, Vietnam, Watergate, economic downturns. We're simply watching the gradual end times, he writes, of what was a slower, more gradual process even earlier. What do you say, George?
Well, the people I wrote about and spent a lot of time talking to don't quite remember it that way. They talk about the 50s, 60s, 70s, even the 80s, the early 80s, as the good days. And it, obviously that depended partly on the color of your skin, your gender, and where you lived and what kind of job you had. But there was a widespread memory among the people I met that the basic foundation of life, that is to say a good, secure job that would allow you to support your family, was available into the 80s. So there was this – I wouldn't say it was a few years. I would say it was a few decades. And it may well be that it did depend on our being the just unquestioned victor in World War II and the huge economic powerhouse of the world coming out. Our GDP was just – you know, the size of the rest of the world put together coming out of World War II. But I think that this is more man-made than that. This is more a result of what we've allowed to happen, changing laws, changing norms. I focus a lot in the book on how certain taboos eroded. It became thinkable for bankers to create products that they knew were going to blow up in a few years. It became thinkable for corporate leaders to lay off 10 or 20% of their workforce and get a gigantic bonus from the board for doing so. These were things that were sort of not done in that earlier period because it would have violated the sense of there being something tying people together. And once you start breaking those taboos, it's really hard to reestablish them.
I mean, I can remember.
But I also wanted to say, Tom, that although these are all great questions, the book is more a portrait and a narrative than it is an argument. It has a lot of implicit themes, but as you know from reading it, there are a lot of great books out about inequality, about the decline of the middle class, about problems in our financial sector. I wanted to tell a story, a big story, and to let readers bring their own ideas and politics to it.
Well, and we celebrate the skill of the telling of that story. It really is remarkable, and I highly recommend it. It's just that these lives are long, they're intricate, and you've got a kind of filigree here that we can capture some of on the air, but at the end of the day, you've got to sink your eyes and mind into this and read it to really get the full texture of it. But it's just so resonant with people, and they are eager to get into that conversation with you, George. George Packer's new book is The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. If I may bring our listeners in, Jill's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Jill, you're on the air with George Packer.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to say that I'm in my late 60s, and I grew up in the 50s, and I remember all that. But I think that there were two events. I'm just sticking with Packer's dates of the 70s that really, for me, totally changed the nature of the conversation and the nature of the way that we look at each other. And the first one was Ronald Reagan, not his economic policies, but calling black women welfare queens, gave permission to people to be unkind to each other, basically. And then George W. Bush making it possible for us to lie to ourselves about Iraq, so that those two things, completely changed the nature of how we civically engage, or if we do at all.
Did you think that Barack Obama would change those notes, Jill? Has he?
You know, I hate to say this out loud, but for me, what I see happening with Obama is an inability to have people look at him beyond his color, the people who don't like him. I don't like what I see. I don't like what I hear. It strikes me as very racial, and I don't mean to be divisive about that. I think that people like me have put a lot of faith in him, that he may not be able to follow through on. I also, by the way, was trained by Saul Alinsky, by some of the same people who trained him, and so I understand where he's coming from.
The community organizing front. Hey, Jill, let us pick that up. George Packer, what about it? Do you see turning points? What about the ones Jill points to?
I think they're excellent points. I mean, Jill really gives a kind of overview, a map of the big events of the last generation that are signal points in people's the erosion of trust, the erosion of a sense of being able to count on our leaders. I think she should also add people in finance and business and in the media to the list. It's not just presidents, although they have a huge effect. And I think the election of Obama coinciding with the financial crisis, which did seem like a kind of end of part of our system as we knew it, signaled to a lot of people, including me, that we were at one of those transformational moments like 1932 when Roosevelt was elected in the middle of the Depression, or 1980 when Reagan was elected in the middle of the economic disasters of the late 70s. And it didn't happen. Obama just has not been able to leverage the presidency into a new way of thinking, talking, and acting. It may yet happen. These things can take a long time, and I don't want to be the short-sighted Washington-centric pundit that is easy to become when you're talking about this stuff. But it hasn't happened yet, and part of that is because these institutions don't work. I mean, just to name one, the Senate, which was created to be the most far-sighted, broadest, most sort of able to see the whole national interest and not just sectional or narrow interest. The Senate is now, in some ways, I'd say it functions less well than the House. And it's there is no such thing as a statesman in the Senate. There is a group of people who use its rules and precedents in ways they were never intended to be in order to thwart democracy. And that's a fundamental institution that's broken and seems incapable of fixing itself. That's what I keep coming back to. The regenerative powers of our democracy, which we've seen over and over in our history, are not making themselves felt these days when we most need them.
That's where it starts to get scary because, as you say, we've had big errors. They weren't all good, but that regenerative capacity's been there. People see a question mark sometimes there on the horizon now, closer than the horizon. Let's go to Omaha, Nebraska, and Mike. Mike, you're on the air with George Packer.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Say, I think the Fortune 500 companies actually do more harm to America now than they do good. They used to do a lot of good, but now they're shipping jobs overseas, creating a lot of low-wage jobs, and they really don't help their communities like they used to. And that's really what I think.
So is it a globalization issue, Mike? It's just
yeah, I think that led to it. I mean, the companies are looking at the bottom line all across the world, and they really don't help their communities like they used to in the 60s and 70s. I remember that.
Mike, I appreciate your call from Omaha. George, I mean, there was a time when there was a pretty strong consensus in this country, in the business of America's business, and it looked like that was working out pretty well for a whole lot of people. And now all kinds of assumptions being questioned. You hear Mike in Omaha.
Yeah, you know, you asked about the celebrities in the book. If you were to look for their counterparts, say, 40 years, 50 years ago, they were sitting on these business, labor, government councils. You know, they didn't maybe like each other all that much, but they sat on these councils and tried to come up with answers to big problems like automation or globalization or, you know, the need for a new kind of job training. And they actually cooperated with each other because they understood that in the end they depended on each other and no one could get too big and powerful in that equation. And now that no longer exists whatsoever. And instead, every headline seems to be about outsourcing, about hiding taxes overseas, and about corporations which since the recession have increased their profits more than they have in 60 years. Corporations are sitting on more cash than any time in 60 years. And they're not hiring. Now, partly that may be because they're uncertain about the immediate future. I think it's partly because they don't feel any pressure to. That's good. Gets back to norms and taboos. There's no sense that there's a shame in having all this cash, maybe distributed as dividends, maybe reinvested in capital equipment, but not in hiring, which is what's desperately needed around the country because they no longer feel that loyalty. Tammy Thomas, who you mentioned earlier, worked for 20 years for Packard Electric and Auto Parts Factory in Youngstown, one of the last sort of good blue-collar jobs in that city after the steel mills shut down. Packard Electric became Delphi, which went through a kind of strategic bankruptcy in order to get rid of people like Tammy. And she lost her job. She just missed out on her pension and had to reinvent herself as a community organizer. Jill earlier mentioned Saul Alinsky. You know, that's kind of the spirit in which Tammy is now operating. But that's very much about being a free agent and no longer having that old structure that had kept her and her children alive.
Taboos going away, lost. People making fortunes on giving advice when we don't know what the rules are anymore. Read Oprah. People making a fortune. However necessary, read Jay-Z. He's behind us right here. George Packer's new book is The Unwinding. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Had to lace up my boots even harder. Father is too far away to father. Further, more other kids either. Smoke reefer or either. Move white. There's few writers in my cipher. So they made lighter my typer. Dreams seem dumb. They said wiser. How many guys are you see making it from here? The world don't like us. Is that not clear? All right, but I'm different. I can't base what I'm gonna be off of what everybody isn't. They don't listen, just whispering behind my back. No vision, lack of ambition. So whack.
Word up. For me is them telling me what I could not be. Oh, well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New Yorker writer George Packer about the end of America as we've known it and what comes next. His big new book is The Unwinding, an Inner History of the New America. George, lots of people writing in here. Scott says, we, the underpaid and overworked 99%, are told save and bootstrap it by people who were born with a trust fund, whose boots are made by Gucci, our minimum wage and families to provide for. We're supposed to save what? How? We boiled our bootstraps a long time ago. And here, Brett writes, if it's true, what you're describing, George, he says, if it's true, we will see a revolution 10, maybe 20 years from now. People aren't equipped to accept such a breakdown. What's more, it's very likely an ongoing destruction that may very well accelerate in the coming years. You quote some pretty smart people. Peter Thiel, for one, a PayPal founder in here, who sounds like he's worried about the same things as Brett.
It's interesting. Peter Thiel, who's a really
billionaire,
ideological libertarian, yeah. I think it's fair to say, nonetheless, is a skeptic about Silicon Valley having all the answers. You know, some people out there really do think that they're changing the world with their products and making it a better place automatically. And Peter Thiel is more, has a sort of darker view. He says, has the internet really improved living standards across the board? Has it done what the automobile and other industrial age inventions did 50, 60 years ago, 70 years ago? It hasn't. Not yet. Will it? We don't know. But it's... Yeah, on the one hand, you know, I put a lot of blame on the 1% because they are the leaders and they have benefited the most.
Yeah.
And that's why there are these portraits of celebrities. Not all of them are quite so negative. In fact, some of them are rather affirmative. But mm-hmm. there is a sense in which they have not kept their end of the bargain of being leaders and elites in a democracy. I think you can also say that perhaps in response to this sense of being left behind— a lot of people have also stopped keeping their end of the bargain.
Regular folks, you mean, not titans?
Yeah, regular folks.
Silicon Valley.
Right. People who maybe, you know, haven't made sure that their kids got a good education, people who haven't made sure that their family stayed healthy, people who, you know, in Dean's part of the country, for example, mm-hmm. which is really heartland America, very conservative, southern, you know, mm-hmm. culture, there's been crack and crystal meth in a big way. There are lots of people living on disability who could be working. There's a lot of obesity, and there's just a lot of, you know, a sense of people sinking into their own discontent and disaffection, and mm-hmm. rather than struggling to rise out of it. And I don't like to put the blame on people who are at the bottom end of society because Jill is right. When Reagan talked about welfare queens, she put it beautifully. He sort of gave us the green light to be unkind to each other. But we have to be realistic and see that people can become responsible for their own problems. And I saw a lot of that in different places, not just in North Carolina and Youngstown, yeah. but also in Tampa, where there were people living beyond their means, using their houses as cash machines and easy investment properties. It was a kind of easy come, easy go economy. And we know what happened to the housing market a few years back, and it wiped people out. And suddenly there was no foundation under them. They had not been building a life that had a solid foundation.
But there again, there's the chicken and egg thing. Is it them because they took the loan? Is it the bankers because they packaged the loans? Is it the elites? Is it the ordinary people? I mean, at a certain point, I can't tell exactly where you're channeling Peter Thiel here, the billionaire, and where it's you, George Packer. But you're right. Elites had become complacent. He said the establishment has been coasting for a long time and was out of answers. Its failure pointed to new directions, maybe Marxist, maybe libertarian, along a volatile trajectory that it could no longer control. This seems to rhyme with our online commenter's question about where this goes and the volatility of it.
Well, what you just quoted is certainly channeling Peter Thiel. And in general, there is no first person in this book anywhere, you might have noticed, which mm-hmm. is a new way of writing for me and a very liberating one. Mm-hmm. I allow the characters to step forward and speak directly to the reader in the third person, but through their own voice mm-hmm. and their own diction and rhythms and jokes. And it's more novelistic in that way than any nonfiction I've written. I'm sympathetic to much of the thinking of my characters, which is why I wanted to spend all that time with them and get to know them and tell their stories. But in the end, I'm essentially presenting the world as they have known it,
yeah.
and allowed them to tell their own story through me as a medium.
What about his fear then, or his anticipation of this volatility that we're wading into here? And who knows what comes out of it, libertarian or Marxist or revolution, our listener writes.
You know, a number of characters in the book say there's going to be chaos in the streets. There's a foreclosure defense attorney down in the Tampa area named Matt Widener who talks that way a lot. Dean Price imagined his neck of the woods becoming sort of revolutionary with a lot of people armed. You know, it hasn't happened. I thought if something like that, God forbid, were going to happen, it would have been a few years ago at the very depths of what I think of as the Second Depression. Americans, you know, life works well enough for enough people, and there's still enough faith that we will come through, that, you know, there's something incredibly elastic about our democracy. That I don't want there to be violence, but I do want there to be clear-eyed assessments of where we are. And sometimes it seems like we can slip into our, you know, highly entertained, highly distracted lives, with iPhones giving us everything we think we need, and lose sight of the fact that there is something is wrong, that something is fundamentally wrong.
Yeah. Kim in Rock Island, Illinois, you're on the air with George Packer. Kim, thanks for calling.
Well, and a happy Tuesday. You give me new faith. I all along, to me, our problems back in the 70s, when you were mentioning time frames, CEOs made four or five times more than the average employee. We flash forward 40 years, and CEOs are making 500 to 700 times more than the average employee. We can fix this. I mean, and we're in a situation where basically we want the same things that Tunisia and Egypt and Libya wanted, but we don't have to be violent. We can do it out of kindness, compassion, forgiveness. We have a president that understands this. It is time for us to step up and bring morals back. And just like you were talking about the gentleman with the chicken restaurant, there are enough people out there that are willing to do this.
Kim, I love the faith. George, I can't tell if you share it. I mean, Kim says, you know, bring back morals, bring back kindness and compassion. We can deal with this. But you write that this void that's emerged in the unwinding has been filled by the default force in American life, organized money.
Yeah, which is everywhere. I love what Kim says, and I want to be right there with her. And I am, in the sense that I think the basic problem is we will have a better society when we want it. This is a human problem. It is not a natural disaster. It's not a tornado. It's not a hurricane. Getting there is hard because we all feel somewhat powerless and like history is just sweeping us aside, especially people in, say, the bottom 80% of the country, which is a ton of people.
Yes, it is.
It's a lot of people who don't think their voices are
terrible.
Being heard.
They have to say that sentence.
It is. But that's the way it's shaken down. But, you know, she mentioned corporate pay. Those executives make that stratospheric amount of money even when they do badly. That's why the game seems rigged to ordinary people. If Mark Zuckerberg were leading a company, as he has, that has seen its valuation go up and up and up, then you could say, yeah, he deserves every penny of it. But if, you know, the head of another company that has, you know, done badly and seen its stock decline, et cetera, continues to get that kind of money from the board because there's a cozy arrangement between the CEO and the board, the game is rigged. And in so many different ways, the game is rigged, which was a phrase that Elizabeth Warren used. She's one of the celebrities in the book. She used that phrase at the Democratic National Convention last year. She was chided by a lot of pundits who said, you know, that's much too strong. That's not the kind of talk that we should get from our leaders. She was telling the truth. And one reason why Elizabeth Warren has been such a sensation is because it's rare for someone with her profile and her access to power to talk in that way. We've gotten used to a much milder, more conciliatory way of describing the social arrangement and the way in which it's unraveled coming from our leaders. I think Elizabeth Warren is pretty on target when she talks in more old-fashioned, unvarnished populist terms. And maybe that's a little sign that, you know, you get a few people talking that way in positions of power and acting on it, things do change. There is the ability of self-correction.
You're writing this week, we've gone back to Gatsby's time or something far more perverse. So what's your faith of it turning around? I mean, you remind us we've had tough, sort of fallow, bad, dark patches before, the Civil War foremost, but not only the Civil War. And yet you kind of scare us, George, because you say the elasticity of our politics is not what it has been. The system itself seems to be jammed up somehow.
You know, one way that you could think about it that you're not supposed to talk about and that our leaders won't talk about is what we're seeing is a kind of inevitable decline in a in a country that really had enormous power for most of the 20th century. And we know that great powers decline. We've seen it over and over again. And there's nothing exceptional about America as a great power. And it may be that Barack Obama's job is to manage that decline, to make it as tolerable and equitable and successful as possible, a successful decline. Maybe that's what our leaders should really be aiming for and talking about in a way that doesn't leave two-thirds of the country behind.
Because there's a lot,
you know, it could get a lot worse than it is now. So, but you can't talk that way if you're in a position of power. You have to say America's going to come back as strong as before. I would rather we said, we've had our moment as the great power, and now we're going to be a power, and we're going to be a more just and fair and free power.
There's a great goal right there. George Packer's new book is The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. That's a tall order. Let's work for that. George, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
In a moment, Stephen Colbert's address to the University of Virginia's class of 2013. This is On Point. On Saturday, comedian Stephen Colbert spoke to the University of Virginia's 2013 graduating class. Colbert's wife attended UVA as a student. Colbert did not. His application to attend as a transfer student, he told new graduates, was rejected. He joked about the university's notable alum, Georgia O'Keeffe, its dropout, Edgar Allan Poe, its founder, Thomas Jefferson. He concluded with the mandatory words of advice for graduates. Here's an excerpt of Stephen Colbert's address.
I'm going to take this opportunity to move on to the advice section of the speech. If you young folks will take advice from anyone, after all, I don't know if you've seen it, this week's Time magazine called you lazy, entitled narcissists who are part of the me generation. So self-obsessed, tweeting your Vines, hashtagging your Spotifys, and Snapchatting your YOLOs. Your generation needs everything to be about you. And that's very upsetting to us baby boomers because self-absorption is kind of our thing. We're the original me generation. We made the last 50 years all about us. We took all the money. We soaked up all the government services. And we've deep-fried nearly everything in the ocean. It may seem that all that's left for you is unpaid internships, Monday to Tuesday mail delivery, and thanks to global warming, soon semester at sea will mean sailing the coast of Ohio. Now, in our defense, in my generation's defense, how were we supposed to know that you were coming? We thought it went like this: every successive generation of mankind, and then us. Ta-da! Roll credits. But while we may be leaving you with an economy with fewer job opportunities for the new graduate to slip into, while traditional paths may seem harder to find, that also means that you may learn sooner than most generations the hard lesson that you must always make the path for yourself. There is no secret society out there that will tap you on the shoulder one night and show you the way. Because the true secret is, your life will not be defined by the society that we have left you. To paraphrase Robert Bolt, society has no more idea of what you are than you do, because ultimately, it has only your brains to think with. Every generation must define itself, and so make the world that suits itself. So, if you must find your own path, and we have left you no easy path, then decide now to choose the hard path that leads to the life and the world that you want. And don't worry if we don't approve of your choices. In our benign self-absorption, I believe we have given you a gift, a particular form of independence, because you do not owe the previous generation anything. Thanks to us, you owe it to the Chinese. So have the courage to follow the example of your founder, Thomas Jefferson, the greatest mind of that most daring generation, to create something new for yourselves and lay its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to you shall seem most likely to affect your safety and happiness. And know that though he wrote these words 237 years ago, that this generation, no less than his generation, has their own opportunity to recognize and seize that moment when, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the bands that have connected them with another and assume among the powers of the earth your separate and equal station, and for the support of this, mutually pledge to each other your lives, your fortune, and your sacred honor. If anyone can do this, it is the graduates of the university that Jefferson founded. You are his intellectual heirs. In fact, some of you may be his actual heirs. We're still testing the DNA. So thank you for this honor, and congratulations to the class of 2013. Wahoo wah.
Comedian Stephen Colbert, addressing the University of Virginia's 2013 graduating class on Saturday. For a full video of his address, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Tomorrow, we look at Apple and offshore tax havens. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.